What are the prospects that the presence of chemical weapons in Syria could serve as a pretext for a near future international intervention in that country? Are we witnessing an echo of the lead up to the Iraq War, which similarly invoked weapons of mass destruction in the hands of terrorists as a casus belli? What is the strategic significance of Syria to the major powers? Will the recent Israeli airstrikes on Syrian targets signal an expansion of the conflict? And what kind of regional reconfiguration could result from regime change in Syria? Political analysts Michelle Chosadovsky and Rick Rozoff offer their perspectives in the next hour. On today's program, Syria, the next domino to fall. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 9th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We now debut for you a brand new feature on the Global Research News Hour. It's called News Notes, a sampling of some of the recently featured articles on the Global Research news site. It is likely that Al-Qaeda rebels and not the Syrian government carried out the chemical weapons attack, which the hawks in Washington are trying to use as a reason to invade. Haaretz reported on March 24th, quote, "Jihadists, not Assad, apparently behind reported chemical attack in Syria." The Syria Tribune released a video in December allegedly showing Syrian rebels killing rabbits with chemical weapons and threatening to use them against supporters of the Syrian government. It is impossible at this point to say whether this is genuine or propaganda. Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson, the former Chief of Staff to Secretary of State Colin Powell under President George W. Bush, said yesterday that Syrian chemical weapons could be a, quote, "Israeli false flag operation," unquote. That was from an article entitled, "Bush Official, Syria Chemical Weapons Attack Could Be Israeli False Flag Operation," by Washington's blog, dated May 3rd. Former FBI translator Sybelle Edmonds has been deemed credible by the Department of Justice's Inspector General, several senators, and a coalition of prominent conservative and liberal groups. Edmonds said last week that bin Laden and his number two Al-Qaeda lieutenant, Ayman al-Zawahiri, worked with the U.S. government for 3 months after 9/11 to coordinate destabilization in the Caucasus region. By way of background, the former Italian prime minister, an Italian judge, and the former head of Italian counterintelligence admit that NATO, with the help of the Pentagon and CIA, carried out terror bombings in Italy and other European countries in the 1950s and blamed the communists in order to rally people's support for their governments in Europe in their fight against communism. This was codenamed Operation Gladio. Edmonds says that some portions of Operation Gladio are continuing to this day, and that Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden worked for NATO and the Pentagon as part of Operation Gladio. That's from an article entitled, 3 months after 9/11, U.S. and NATO worked with bin Laden and his top lieutenant, by Washington's blog, dated May 3rd. The military standoff between India and China along their border, the disputed Line of Actual Control, LAC, separating Tibet from the Ladakh area of the Indian state of Jammu and Kashmir, is continuing into its third week. Several rounds of bilateral negotiations have failed to end the standoff. The third flag meeting between military officers from both sides, held Tuesday, did not resolve the issue. While Chinese officials insisted on their demands that India dismantle infrastructure it has built in eastern Ladakh, including bunkers and roads close to LAC, India demanded the unconditional withdrawal of Chinese troops, which it claims have intruded into Indian territory. The Chinese demands tend to support reports that its military activity in the region is a response to India's buildup of military infrastructure along the border. The current Sino-Indian standoff emerged amid the Obama administration's pivot to Asia, aimed at containing China, during which the U.S. has encouraged its allies such as Japan, the Philippines, and Vietnam to take aggressive stances in territorial disputes with China. That's from an article entitled Military Standoff Between China and India by Deepal Jayasekara from the World Socialist website. On Monday, April 29th, U.S. Army Private Kimberly Rivera, a pregnant mother of four, was sentenced by court-martial to 10 months in prison and given a bad conduct discharge for crossing into Canada in 2007 to avoid redeployment to Iraq. Rivera said in a 2007 interview, quote, "I had a huge awakening, seeing the war as it truly is, people losing their lives for greed of a nation, and the effects on the soldiers who come back with new problems such as nightmares, anxieties, depression, anger, alcohol abuse, missing limbs, and scars from burns." In August of last year, the Canadian government ordered Rivera to be deported into the hands of U.S. authorities. She turned herself in at the border. On April 29th, the Army sentenced her to 14 months for desertion. Under a pretrial agreement, Rivera will serve 10 months in a military prison. She will give birth behind bars in December. That's from an article entitled, "A Pregnant Mother of Four Sentenced to 10 Months in Prison by U.S. for Resisting the Iraq War" by Naomi Spencer from the World Socialist website dated May 4th. The Boston bombing served as a detonator to mobilize the entire U.S. security apparatus. It has led to the suspension of constitutional guarantees. The Boston bombings coincided with the White House dictating a new round of domestic police state measures and launching a series of aggressive military moves in Asia, the Middle East, and Latin America. The targeted countries have global significance. Venezuela and Iran are oil-producing giants, the backbone of OPEC, and adversaries of Israel. China is the second biggest economy in the world and the principal challenger to U.S. economic dominance. Cowering and confusing millions of downwardly mobile Americans weakens the principal domestic obstacle to bigger and more comprehensive cuts in social programs in order to finance global wars. That's from an article entitled "Boston Bombings Detonator to Mobilize the Entire U.S. Security Apparatus May Change the World for the Worse" by James Petrus, dated April 30th. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Global Research is an independently run media hub for news, analysis, and opinion. To maintain its independence, Global Research does not receive funding from public or private foundations. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. President Barack Obama has made it clear that the use of chemical weapons by the Bashar al-Assad government in Syria would be a major game changer in determining whether or not the U.S. intervenes militarily in that country. Not unlike Iraq 10 years ago, the weapons of mass destruction meme is evolving as the dominant casus belli in the two-year-old conflict. A UN fact-finding mission claimed to find no evidence of the Syrian government using these weapons. However, Barack Obama is facing pressure from within the U.S. to launch an offensive or at least arm the rebels fighting Assad. To examine the question more broadly of chemical weapons in Syria, we are joined once again by Professor Michelle Chosadovsky, award-winning author, professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal, and editor of the globalresearch.ca website. Thanks again for joining us, Michelle Chosadovsky.
I'm delighted to be on the program. I think it's worth pointing out that the rebels, which are essentially Al-Qaeda operatives financed out of Qatar and Saudi Arabia, have been in possession of chemical weapons for quite some time. And in fact, the Western media acknowledges that the rebels have chemical weapons. How do they acknowledge it? Well, in fact, they say that they have dispatched contractors to Syria to actually train the rebels in the use of chemical weapons. And this is, in fact, even confirmed by CNN. And essentially, the Syria chemical weapons saga started last August with Washington pointing its finger at President Bashar al-Assad without a shred of evidence, then saying, and this was the game plan, then saying that the chemical weapons bunkers of the Syrian armed forces could be attacked by the rebels, that is the rebels that we actually support, and they could fall in the hands of the rebels. So that, in effect, from day one, when the Pentagon launched this propaganda campaign, they were also pointing to the fact that, or pointing to a concern that the jihadist rebels who are fighting government forces, that these weapons would fall in their hands. And, I mean, this was actually confirmed by the Los Angeles Times back in August, and it was also confirmed by CNN.
Professor Chostovsky, how exactly, like, where did those chemical weapons come from? Were they brought in from outside, or were they from Syria itself? Where did they, I mean, if they're being trained, you said that they have access to the chemical weapons already. Where did they come from? What was their origin point?
Well, there's no clear confirmation of that. There was one report suggesting that one of the chemical weapons deposits had been attacked by the rebels. And there were earlier reports that the rebels themselves had used the chemical weapons against civilians, okay? So that, and these reports have been ongoing for the last few months. But again, the WMD saga is essentially to pin the responsibility on President Bashar al-Assad. It's a slap in the face because Carla Del Ponte and the United Nations Independent Mission have said, no, this is not what is happening. And in fact, the evidence is that the rebels possess these chemical weapons. And I don't need to read the independent report. All I need to do is to read CNN to know that the rebels have these chemical weapons. Okay, this has been known for several months. But the fact that the United Nations actually reads the CNN and Los Angeles Times reports, plus the investigations that they conduct, in Syria, points to the fact that this is a historical lie, because it's being used essentially to put pressure on Syria, to create a situation of escalation with regard to military undertakings and so on. But the fact of the matter is that this UN mission is not particularly pro-Syrian, okay? If we look at Carla Del Ponte, who is, she's a prominent jurist, but she was in charge of the United Nations sponsored ICTY, the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia, back in the heyday of the, in the early 2000s. She has taken, on balance, a pretty strong pro-NATO perspective. But there is a shred of honesty in these UN reports, in these UN missions, to the fact that you can't simply lie through. You have to be a little bit smarter when you lie. And what's happening is that Obama is lying, and in the same way as Colin Powell lied, you know, in February 2003 at the United Nations Security Council. They're saying, yes, weapons of mass destruction. They're repeating it ad nauseum. They have the support of the media. And then slap in the face the United Nations mission, which was dispatched with independent observers. So they come up and say, no, it's the rebels who are in, who have the chemical weapons. Mind you, the mission of the Arab League, which was sent in the same way, that was last year, they came up pretty much. They came up with a very critical report, blaming where they said the rebels are involved in atrocities directed against civilians, including executions, the killing of children, and so on and so forth, mass murder, which was blamed on the Syrian government. They came up with a balanced report, and then what happened? You know, the report right. itself was simply, it was shelved, and nobody dared to even use that report to challenge the lies and fabrications of the international media and of course, the U.S. State Department.
Professor Chostovsky, you referred to Iraq earlier and the weapons of mass destruction claim, which proved to be erroneous. And I'm wondering if like, I know you wrote an article recently, or it was a repost, I guess, the Syrian chemical weapons saga, the staging of a U.S.-NATO-sponsored humanitarian disaster. And you're suggesting that there is a difference between the WMD casus belli as it in Iraq as opposed to what we're seeing here. Is it possible you could just elaborate a little more on how that is playing differently?
Exactly. I don't think the purpose here at this stage is to conduct an all-out shock and war on Syria involving a full-fledged air campaign. At least that's what I wrote when I wrote this article several months ago. I suspect that under present conditions, this would be a highly risky undertaking because Syria has taken delivery of some very advanced Russian missile systems, and so that the air defense system is fairly well organized in Syria, as opposed to Iraq, where it had been totally demolished. So that, you know, the theater-type operation, and that was Donald Rumsfeld's Blitzkrieg perspective. I think that under this administration, what they are contemplating is to escalate this undeclared war. I don't think that they would risk a theater war with an air campaign at this moment. The Russians have said that they would respond. It was very categorical. John Kerry was in Moscow for talks with Vladimir Putin. I think really what they want to do is essentially twist the arms of the Russians and the Chinese with a view to coming up with regime change in Syria. And they're doing. They're looking at various options, but at the same time, it's important to emphasize that they are losing. That the United States-sponsored rebels are losing the war. Okay, these foot soldiers. They're terrorists. They're trained in Qatar. They're mercenaries, they're sent in, they're recruited from different countries. In fact, NATO actually recruits them. There's no secret about that. They have a campaign to recruit Mujahideen. And they train them in Qatar, they train them in Saudi Arabia, they send them in, and they are being wiped out. They're being killed. So that, in effect, this insurrection, which now is moving into its third year, is in a situation, it's in a dead alley, and the United States and its allies, including Israel, don't know how to tackle, what what will be their next step, so that the Israeli bombings of May 5th are certainly part of this agenda. It's the agenda of creating disturbances, destabilizing a nation state, undermining its economy. And I should mention that the strikes by Israel, which were directed against a suburb in Damascus, it was a research center. This is not strictly an Israeli strike. It is a U.S.-Israeli strike. It had the green light from the United States. Israel does not act unilaterally. And this is very important, because when John Kerry went to Moscow and made a statement, in fact, I think he made this statement yesterday, he was talking about, mediation, namely getting all sides together, the opposition, the government, etc. But you can't be a mediator when you are yourself the aggressor. And that John Kerry should understand it. He's right. A Vietnam War veteran. You cannot mediate in a conflict in which you are directly involved. And the United States is directly involved in supporting Israel, in backing it with military aid, and in supporting the rebels. And the rebels are Al-Qaeda-affiliated. It's the Al-Qaeda-affiliated Al-Nusra. And Israel is also supporting these jihadist forces.
Professor Chasudovsky, I'm wondering if you could, because I think it's a very important point to make, that this issue of them of the rebels being essentially Al-Qaeda, because we keep hearing about the controversy of like whether or not the United States and the other Western forces should be providing military assistance to these quote unquote freedom fighters. Could you help nail that point that we know for sure that this is an Al-Qaeda operatives and not, as we tend to be focused on just people fighting for democracy in Syria?
There's been absolutely no people fighting for democracy in Syria right from the beginning. No, these are Al-Qaeda formations. There are other formations as well. The Muslim Brotherhood is involved. There are various contingents, but the most effective mercenary forces are those which are affiliated to Al-Qaeda. And as we know, Al-Qaeda is a creation of the CIA, going back to the Soviet-Afghan War. So, in fact, they're doing exactly the same as what they did in other war theaters. They did it in Afghanistan. They did it in
the late 70s, you mean?
In the late 70s. But that war extended right through the 90s. They also supported Mujahideen in Chechnya, okay, the breakaway autonomous region of the Russian Federation. It was a CIA-led operation. It's important to mention that in the wake of the Boston bombings. They did it in Libya, where they supported the Libya Islamic Fighting Group. All those leaders of these movements were trained in CIA camps in Pakistan. The Chechen rebel movement supposed to be an enemy of America. That's the Boston bombing narrative. But the two main leaders, Shamil Bazaev and Al-Khattab, were trained in CIA camps, and then they were dispatched to the war theater in Chechnya, the first Chechnya war, the second Chechnya war. We're going back, to the early to late 90s, depending on the different stages of these wars. And then you had Libya Islamic Fighting Group, their leaders also trained by the CIA in Pakistan and Afghanistan. So that these are the foot soldiers of the Western Military Alliance, and people should understand, because the lies are so obvious. We have tons and tons of documentation to the effect that Al-Qaeda is supported by Western intelligence.
Al, you've indicated previously and in your article that what we're seeing is essentially an attempt to invoke some kind of an R2P responsibility to protect intervention. And while we can, it's been pointed out that R2P is sort of like a mask for a, you know, intervention for other reasons. But I'm wondering how you would make the case to say a Romeo Dallaire, who spoke at the University of Winnipeg recently, this idea that there is a serious humanitarian catastrophe in Syria, and if we don't intervene militarily, like what ways are there to protect the Syrian people from the bad guys on all sides?
So. Well, the way to protect the Syrian people is to demand an unconditional withdrawal of all foreign supported mercenaries which are presently in the country and which are waging an illegal war. This is a war in which the United States and its allies are already involved. It's not a civil war. It never has been a civil war. Right from day one, those mercenaries were there. I was in Syria up until the end of February of 2011. I left about 2 weeks before the so-called protest movement started. But in fact, it was an insurrection right from day one. And you had the jihadist Salafist fighters coming in from Jordan. And that is so well documented. Now, there is an opposition within Syria. But they are not associated with the insurrection. This is not to say that the Syrian government is some kind of ideal state. It's not. It's an authoritarian government. But at the same time, it's the only remaining secular government in the Middle East. And the objective of the United States and its allies is to topple this government, which has withheld, resisted colonial penetration, and replace it by some kind of Muslim Brotherhood government, as in Egypt or in Tunisia. And these are governments which are very easily manipulated very easily, and you impose a neoliberal agenda on them. So from day one in Daraa, that was in March 2011, this has been an insurrection, an armed insurrection, financed by foreign forces. And the way you implement, if there's a responsibility to protect, then you need to send in missions which will disarm these rebels. That's the only solution. It is to disarm the rebels and to withdraw from a country, whatever its political inclinations are, withdraw from a country and let that country resolve its own problems. That's the whole, that's the whole issue of sovereignty. We can't simply go into a country and invade them and send in al-Qaeda on the grounds that we don't like the government of Bashar al-Assad. I think people should understand, first of all, that we are at a very dangerous crossroads, particularly people in the anti-war movement. The anti-war movement in Canada has virtually collapsed. This is not strictly a war directed against Syria. It is a roadmap of military undertakings. And war planning in relation to Syria is integrated with war planning in relation to Iran. If a major theater operation breaks out, it would then lead to escalation. It would also imply that the existing war theaters in the Middle East and Central Asia, which are essentially Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, of course, Palestine, all these hotspots would ultimately integrate with one another, particularly if Iran becomes actively involved in the conflict.
Okay. Professor Michel Chossadovsky is the award-winning author, Emeritus Professor of Economics at the University of Ottawa, founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, and editor of the globalresearch.ca website. Professor Chossadovsky, thanks again for joining us.
Delighted to be on the program.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Over the weekend, Israel launched two airstrikes against Syrian military facilities near the capital Damascus, killing as many as 300 soldiers, according to some sources. Syria, in response, is targeting Israeli-specific sites in the event of future aggression. The Israelis say they were defending themselves against the transfer of weapons to Hezbollah militants. This latest action takes place in the midst of a two-year-old conflict, which has claimed the lives of tens of thousands of Syrians, with over a million displaced. Do the airstrikes by Israel signal an expansion of the Syrian conflict? And what is the wider endgame? To resolve these questions, we're joined on the line by Rick Rozoff. Rick Rozoff is a Chicago-based campaigner against war, militarism, and intervention. He manages the Stop NATO website and writes on the threat of international militarization. He's also a frequent contributor to Global Research. So thank you very much for joining us, Rick Rozoff.
Well, it's both a pleasure and an honor to be on your show.
I'm wondering if you'd like to comment on whether, you know, the extent to which Israel's recent actions were independent of the United States, or whether they were in some sense coordinated, because what the public messaging is that, you know, Barack Obama is suggesting, well, we got to exercise restraint, and then here Israel comes along with this very what appears to be a very rash act. So, you know, to what extent do you believe that Israel is acting as sort of like a rogue element here?
I don't believe it's rogue at all. I think, as you're indicating or implying in your prefatory statements, that this is a coordinated action, a good cop, bad cop, if you will, as you've indicated, where the White House or the State Department can get up and speak in diplomatic tones, while knowing full well its major military ally in the world, Israel, was planning to strike Syria. Without question, Tel Aviv would not have resorted to such actions without informing the United States and the United States approving them. And the two attacks you mentioned, depending on which part of the world dates we're using, between May 3rd and 5th, on sites in Syria, these are not just acts of war. This is the opening salvo in a full-fledged war. This is an attack by one sovereign nation against an unoffending second sovereign nation, pure and simple. That's all it is. The Orwellian inversion of concepts and words that you've alluded to, the fact, for example, that Israel attacking and killing as many, and by the way, that figure of 300 Syrian troops being killed has its source, I believe, in the London Observatory of Human Rights, the opposition so-called organization in London that seems to be proud and happy and joyous, exultant, to celebrate the fact that 300 fellow citizens have been killed by Israel, long-term geopolitical adversary of their homeland. This is the sorts of traitors we're dealing with, who are trying to pass themselves off as advocates of, an Arab Spring in Damascus. But, the fact that, Israel launches such a nakedly aggressive military attacks, actually two of them, near the capital of Syria, and presents that as a defensive action, because presumably missiles might have, wound up in Lebanon and be used by Hezbollah against Israel is ludicrous, of course. It is an inversion of the truth. That the United States then positions itself, the U.S. government, to state, as Israel was forced to take this, this is ironic, of course, forced to take this defensive measure against Syria, we have no choice but to defend Israel when Syria threatens retaliation. You can see how people are being set up with this. Yesterday's Washington Post, for example, had an article, the headline of which read something to the effect that Israel's action may force U.S.'s hand, as though the U.S. really needed any encouragement to move further again in the direction of regime change in Damascus. And, yesterday also the chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, a Democrat, Dan Menendez, you know, introduced a resolution to openly arm the Syrian opposition. Now, the Israeli, you know, rationale for striking Damascus two times this past week and three times this year so far, you know, in, under the guise that it's you know, protecting itself from fantastical and imaginary missile strikes from Lebanon. Let's reverse that situation, Michael. Let's say that the government in Damascus says Turkey, Qatar, United Arab Emirates, other nations that are providing arms to, you know, what the Syrian government labels as terrorists, operating across the border from Turkey, from Jordan, from the north of Iraq, that these countries are supplying weapons that are, you know, being used against Syria and against civilians in Syria. So Damascus has a right to launch a military attack, you know, outside the capitals of Turkey or Qatar or the United Arab Emirates or Saudi Arabia. I mean, this would be, the, you know, employing the same rationale that Israel and the United States are using. If turnabout is fair play, then Syria would have all the more reason to do something like that, in which case, of course, it would be accused of naked and brutal aggression and, you know, all-out war be launched against it.
One can imagine if, certainly, or never mind, if the United States had 300 of their soldiers on, say, a U.S. protectorate had just been killed
on American
such
soil.
Yeah. Then what would the response be? Yeah. They probably want to impeach the president for not taking retaliatory action. But
you remember the, you know, the Fuhrer in 1983 when 200 some U.S. Marines were killed outside the airport in Beirut, Lebanon. You know, which led to even the super hawk Ronald Reagan withdrawing the remaining troops in short order. But, you know, as we're talking about, imagine those three troops being stationed at a U.S. You know, military facility near the Capitol. Mm-hmm. No, within miles of the White House.
So, like we've got, you know, war pretexts. You know, President Obama's talking about the red line, the game changer being Bashar al-Assad's use of Syrian weapons against his own people, and you know, it seems to me very well documented by the UN in particular reports that the only people that the there's no evidence of the government using chemical weapons. If anything, it's being used by the rebel forces, so called. So, I mean, if we can, I mean, can we pretty much ignore the idea that, I mean, the weapons of mass destruction as a pretext? I mean, is this like, are we looking at Iraq all over again?
I mean, that's been the contention of many of us for years, you know, for 2 years. In fact, that once, you know, and we have to keep in mind we have a U.S. head of state right now who is a graduate of two of the most prestigious, I don't say best, but prestigious universities in the country, you know, Columbia and Harvard, whose vocabulary and whose rhetoric is limited to, you know, the most trite cliches imaginable, game changer, red line. This is apparently what one goes to Ivy League colleges to learn. And, you know, the fact that, you know, these pretenses for escalation of military activity directly or through proxies, you know, against Syria are being peddled. You know, by the way, this is a fully bipartisan, of course, issue in the United States. But, you know, that the White House, again, arrogates to itself the right, you know, to intervene militarily. You know, even if the effort in the Senate yesterday comes to fruition simply as it stated, that is, you know, arms to the so-called rebel opposition groups based on other countries, these are cross-border attacks inside Syria, we have to recall that. That is, attacks from Turkey, from Jordan, from northern Iraq. And, you know, the other talk, before I forget, by the way, and I'm kind of evading a direct response to your last question, but the talk has been, and it's, you know, it's being leaked by the strategist in the Fourth Estate in the West, is that what Israel did over the weekend, as much as, you know, attacking Syria itself, was giving an object lesson to Iran about its ability to launch similar airstrikes inside Iran. So that we have to see this as, you know, an escalation of the conflict beyond borders at this point, where it not only introduces a new actor, Israel is a military belligerent striking inside Syria, but that also, you know, lays the groundwork for an escalation of the conflict, which would inevitably bring Iran into the fray, and quite possibly Russia as well. We have to keep in mind that Russia has made a concerted effort over the last year or so to reassert itself in the Mediterranean Sea, particularly by the increasingly more frequent deployment of Black Sea Fleet vessels into the Mediterranean. But the only base they have access to in the entire sea is that of Tartus in Syria, so that a political regime change inside Syria would be distinctly disadvantageous to Russia from the geopolitical and military points of view, as well as being a preparatory action for an attack against Iran and Lebanon. So that Iraq itself would be pulled into it as well, and then what you could see is a regional conflagration. Apparently, the United States, its NATO allies in the West, Israel, and the monarchies and sheikdoms of the Gulf Cooperation Council and the Persian Gulf are willing to take such risk.
Now, I understand that Israel is essentially a partner in NATO, and I'm recalling, like, back at the time of the Iraq War, that it was a so-called coalition of the willing. Under NATO, they have that Chapter 5 provision, which an attack against one is attack against all, so that all of the NATO partners have to be engaged. So is that maybe a critical difference, a difference of approach compared to what we saw with Bush in Iraq, that they can utilize NATO's charter provisions?
That's a keen point you're raising there, Michael, and the answer is yes, and I'll explain it very briefly. Israel is one of, to date, seven members of a NATO military partnership set up in the 1990s called Mediterranean Dialogue. The other six are Arab nations. They're Arab-speaking nations. They're Arabic-speaking nations. They're Mauritania, Morocco, Tunisia, Algeria, Egypt, and Jordan. Libya, since NATO's six-month air war against it 2 years ago, is now being groomed, as the eighth member of the Mediterranean Dialogue. But Israel was the first of the current seven members of that military partnership to be granted what NATO calls an individual partnership program several years ago. So it was the first to be elevated to a higher rank of military partnership within the Mediterranean Dialogue. Second of all, this is an anomaly, but a very significant one that I don't think is properly recognized, is that Israel is the only nation in the Middle East that is not in the area of responsibility of the Pentagon's Central Command. Central Command takes in, first of all, only one country on the African continent now left, and that's Egypt, which is also significant because of its geographical location, bordering Israel, and its general relationship with Israel. But that Israel alone in that area is under the area of responsibility of European command, though clearly it's not in Europe. And the chief military commander of European command, we have a new one, there's a new one, Philip Breedlove, who is a former commander of U.S. Air Forces in Europe, Air Force Africa, is taking over simultaneously the command of European Command, U.S. European Command, and of NATO, as Supreme Allied Commander NATO. So the special relationship between Israel and European Command is also a special relationship between Israel and NATO. There's been talk, particularly amongst prominent American war hawks, if that's not a redundancy when we're talking about both houses of Congress, with the departure of Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, I wonder if there's anyone in either house of Congress that is not a war hawk. I certainly don't know of any. But nevertheless, that there has been talk in recent years, particularly in relation to the five-day war almost 5 years ago between Georgia and Russia, about the possibility of invoking the Article 5 military intervention clause, collective military intervention clause, for partners as well as full members of NATO, as you were alluding to in relation to Israel. That's one possibility. The Deputy Secretary General, second in command of NATO, an American, Alexander Virzbaum, a couple weeks ago, in speaking about the conflict on the Korean Peninsula, said that if a war ensues between the two Koreas, the U.S. Intervenes, of course, as it would, on behalf of South Korea, and hostilities ensue, then NATO could invoke Article 5 in supposed defense of the United States. So that's another possibility. that if the U.S. intervenes, you know, ostensibly in defense of Israel, and, you know, one Syrian rocket is fired in the direction of a U.S. vessel in the eastern Mediterranean, then NATO could be, NATO leadership bodies can be convened, and they could decide to enter the fray on behalf of the United States by invoking Article 5. So the answer is yes, and under the terms I just described.
How do you see a successful regime change, assuming that that is the game plan here? How would you see the United States on the one hand and Russia on the other benefiting or losing from that reconfiguration?
It's a clear gain for the U.S., NATO, and Israel. Whatever catastrophic scenario would follow regime change in Damascus, that is, whether it's a division of the country into contending warlords, as in Libya evidently right now, the very fact that an independent nation with a foreign policy orientation that was multilateral, rather than being totally subservient to the West, would be a net gain for the U.S. and its NATO allies. We were speaking a moment ago about the Mediterranean dialogue. There are only two Arab countries in the region that would normally be members of the Mediterranean dialogue, that are actually three, technically, that have not joined that program yet. They are Libya, Lebanon, and Syria. As mentioned, both General Secretary of NATO Anders Fogh Rasmussen and also the current or outgoing U.S. Ambassador to NATO Ewald Alder, immediately after the murder of Muammar Gaddafi last 2 years ago, October 2011, openly spoke about incorporating Libya into that program, the Mediterranean Dialogue. And I have no doubt but that the moment, should it be achieved by the West and its Persian Gulf and Israeli allies, that should the regime fall in Damascus, Syria would be immediately primed for membership in the Mediterranean Dialogue, as would Lebanon. And what that would affect, Michael, and I think it's something that, if you really want to talk about geopolitics, let's talk about the big picture here, is that every single nation bordering or in the Mediterranean Sea would be a member or a partner of NATO, bar none. And this is, particularly with the recent elections earlier this year in Cyprus, where the incoming administration, hardly walked into the presidential office before announcing that, Cyprus was going to join another NATO military partnership, the Partnership for Peace. That would mean of, 25 or so countries, littoral and island nations in the Mediterranean, that everyone would be a NATO partner or full member. So that, this is part of the other thing about Syria, I think, that's important, and Lebanon to a slightly lesser extent, is that, of the 22 members of the Arab League, after the overthrow of the government in Libya 2 years ago, Syria is the only Arab nation that does not have a direct military partnership with the United States and or NATO. And I think that's phenomenal. Since the Israeli attack on Lebanon, several years ago, the United States moved in, the Pentagon moved in and started, had multiplied its the degree of its military aid to the Lebanese military in an effort to buy it off. You have NATO nations with affecting both the land blockade of Lebanon from Syria, incidentally, on the Lebanese-Syrian border with the expanded UNIFIL mission, and also the warships off the coast of Lebanon, blockading Lebanon. This has been going on since the last Israeli invasion of Lebanon. So that, the transformation we're looking at is not only the eviction of Russia from its only military base in the entire Mediterranean Sea, and in the process, the aborting of Russian plans to reassert itself militarily in the Mediterranean. You're not only looking at turning the entire Mediterranean Sea basin into a NATO private sea, you're talking about the complete subordination of the 22-member Arab League into a U.S. NATO-dominated bloc. There's another military partnership a little bit to the east of where we're talking about in the Persian Gulf called the Istanbul Cooperation Initiative, which includes formally four but practically all six members of the Gulf Cooperation Council, and which is looking covetously, I can assure you, both at Yemen and Iraq right now as two future members. So that, and even with Palestine, with the Palestinian Authority, Abbas, you know, the president has made statements talking about, you know, NATO troops coming in to affect the transition to an independent Palestine. So you're talking about Syria being the last real holdout, you know, maybe Lebanon again to a slightly lesser extent, against the, you know, the Western domination of the Arab world.
Do you see any set of circumstances that might disrupt or interrupt that, what appears to be an imperial expansion? Is there anything that you could see happening that might, change the game plan, so to speak?
Yes, but at what cost? At what cost in, blood and treasure, particularly blood? You know, what I'm talking about, of course, is the fact that two permanent members of the United Nations Security Council, Russia and China, at the end of 2011 and twice last year, you know, in an unprecedented manner, three times, vetoed U.S. and NATO ally and Persian Gulf ally resolutions aimed at, against the government of Syria, and clearly indicated that they're, prepared to do so again to such an extent that I think the U.S. has rather given up and even trying to manipulate the United Nations preparatory to, say, military action against the government in Syria, as it did Libya 2 years ago. So Russia and China have stood firm on international principle. You know, of course, when they do so, they're accused of coddling a dictator and justifying genocide and, everything else, the gutter press, or the gutter media in the West is capable of spewing. I don't have to remind your listeners of that. But, the fact that has held off, the assault on Syria, there's no question about it, by as much as 2 years. The question is, look what has happened to Syria in the interim. How many lives have been lost? How much division has been sown and exacerbated? How many, how much bad blood that's going to exist for decades? How much material damage, economic damage to the country is in addition to the human tragedy? And, in a sense, as we talked about a few minutes ago, the U.S. and its allies position themselves in such a manner that, once having accomplished their political objective, it doesn't matter what the consequences are, they stand to be the gainer. So, anyone who believes that the United States wanted a stable, democratic Afghanistan or Iraq or Kosovo or Libya or something, is living in a, parallel dimension, world someplace, in another dimension. That is not the intent. The intent is pure and simple to eliminate any outpost of independence. And, the Syrian government represents that, pure and simple. That's entirely the issue.
That sounds like a critical component, then, on that larger geopolitical map. I mean, would that the overthrow of Syria trigger, then, a world war?
Well, the immediate effect would be, the West End moving on Lebanon and, displacing Hezbollah and left-wing political parties, who are patriotic or defending the territory of their country. For example, the claim that Israel bombed sites, rather, that were in some manner, transporting or transiting air defense missiles, is one of the reports I read, to Hezbollah, as though, no force within inside Lebanon has the right to defend its airspace against Israeli intrusions or incursions, also indicates, the nature of the political world we're living in right now, where defense becomes offense and the opposite. But, Lebanon would immediately be then, the next target. This could not but help affect negatively events inside Iraq, where, now with a government dominated by individuals of Shia Muslim background, we also have to keep in mind that what's going on here is a sectarian conflict that the U.S. and Israel have entered into, on behalf of, Sunni Muslim extremist elements. Salafists, Wahhabi, and other extremists that are being supported by, the petrodollars from Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, that in many ways this is not only a war against the Christians in the Middle East. We only have to look at the fact that, a 250,000 estimated Iraqi civilians have been killed or fled since the invasion of the country in 2003, but the same thing is happening to Shiites, in the Arab world. And that, the U.S. is part and parcel of this campaign to wage, sectarian strife and to drive out or exterminate, entire religious communities throughout the Arab world. and that, you know, an overthrow of the government in Damascus would have catastrophic consequences likewise for neighboring nations in the first place, as we talked about, Lebanon and Iraq, but I think, you know, in Iran, you know, surely. But I can't help thinking nations like Turkey and Jordan would be similarly affected, if not to the same degree.
So as we move forward into the summer months, what do you think the public, what were you, will you in particular be watching for as events unroll?
You know, I'm afraid, I was, right before you called me, I was reading something about World War One, the beginning of World War One, and how it went from what was supposed to be a war of offensive maneuvers to a war of attrition. And it was, in fact, a war of attrition for over 4 years, one which took the lives anywhere from 8 to 10 million soldiers. And, you know, what we're talking about is a different strategy, a different Western strategy, and again, I'm including Israel and the Persian Gulf monarchies in this category, the West and its allies. This is different than the 78-day bombing, you know, onslaught against Yugoslavia in 1999. It's different from the invasion of Iraq in 2003, and it's different than, even though it's far longer than the first two, the 6.5-month naval blockade and bombing onslaught against Libya 2 years ago. This is a different scenario, and apparently it's a long, drawn-out war of attrition. And what it's meant to do, and in large part, you know, perhaps the U.S. would have preferred you know, the overthrow of the Syrian government long before now. I can only speculate, but we can see what it's doing. It's, you know, whittling away or wearing down, you know, the forces of the government. It's producing what I fear is going to be irreversible, irremediable damage, social as well as economic within Syria. In which case, I don't know if we are going to see dramatic escalations of the conflict or whether we're just going to see a ongoing, prolonged, sadistic bloodletting, which is what we've seen for, you know, almost 2.25 years now, and what I, you know, is a possibility could continue. However, as we began our discussion by talking about the extremely dangerous Israeli attacks of last weekend inside Syria, then the possibility remains, of course, that some precipitate action by Israel, the United States, Turkey, you know, could lead to a flare-up of action where the Syrian government has no choice but to defend itself, at which point then the U.S. and its allies in Europe, the NATO allies, use that as a pretext for direct Western military intervention. You can't, you know, we have to prepare for it. I think that's what your question is indicating, Michael. We have to prepare ourselves for that eventuality, and we have to warn people that, you know, the nature of the scenarios that will be employed and exploited in order to justify such military action. But, you know, the real hope rests with, you know, nations like Russia and Iran, you know, diplomatically. I'm not talking about military actions, but diplomatically stating thus far, no farther, this is an end. We will not tolerate any more disruption of, you know, the affairs within Syria, any more bloodshed in the country. And it's got to stop. And they, you know, they really should take the initiative at the United Nations, like Russia, China, Iran, should take the initiative in the United Nations and not simply veto resolutions being proposed by the United States and its allies.
Well, Rick Rozoff, it's really been great hearing this analysis from you. It's great talking to you as always. So thank you very much for sharing those perspectives with us. And we'll look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thank you very much for the opportunity.
And we've been speaking with Rick Rozoff, who is a longtime campaigner against war, militarism, and intervention, manages the Stop NATO website, and is a frequent contributor to Global Research.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.